It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Is it global warming? Is it climate change? Well, whatever you call it, it's an issue. It's an issue that's in the news, and we have some people that are embracing this whole development, saying we have to do something about it. Others are saying, I don't even think it's a real issue. There are fewer and fewer of the latter and more of the former. And somebody that's been watching it very closely is Sam Fromatz. And Sam is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. He's been with us before. Sam, welcome back to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sam, one of the things that I like about your job is that you keep an eye on everything related to food and the environment, and you must see these issues, especially when it comes to global warming or climate change, coming at you now from every direction. I mean, you're seeing people that are embracing it and some almost panicking about it, declaring there's a consensus. And then you see others that are still saying, well, I'm not so sure, and maybe it's an exaggerated effect. Is there any change, or is there progress on the issue taking place?
Well, in the food and ag sector, I mean, I think what you're seeing is a greater awareness of how the weather is changing, and whether people want to call that climate change or something else because of the politics of climate change, is one thing. But, among the many farmers that we connect with on these issues, and as you know, a lot of farmers are sort of bedrock conservatives, there's still an awareness that things are changing.
And there's really, that's not even debatable. I mean, pretty much a consensus, isn't there, that the climate is changing?
Well, yeah. Or if they don't believe it's the climate, they'll say the weather is changing. So
yeah.
They don't want to use the term climate change. We did a pretty interesting story about barley farmers in Montana, and that's where a good deal of the malted barley comes from for beer makers. And the barley crop last summer just got whacked by extreme weather, and both heat and drought, sort of coming at precisely the wrong time for the crop. And, farmers there that we talked to were, completely aware of what was going on. You know, whether they wanted to call it climate change or not, they knew that this was an extraordinary year and that it followed, other extraordinary years. So they, farmers are very practical. They're very wary of the politics of these issues, but they know, that they're in the crosshairs of something that's affecting what they do, and so in that sense, yeah, I think there's an awareness. And most farmers I think we talk about the climate affecting them in one way or another.
It's interesting because I've talked to some people that are involved in various organizations, and they just don't like the term because, it reminds them of Al Gore, and they were partisan, and they thought that it was being used it was shoved down their throat, that they were to blame for a lot of the issues, and felt that it was a very partisan political move. And so they find it very difficult to use those terms. You're saying, they're agreeing that there's a lot of changes taking place.
The idea that someone is shoving it down their throats or forcing them to change, or that definitely can happen, especially if you sort of view government's role as, to try and do something about this, but it definitely, rubs some people the wrong way. But, the flip side of that is things aren't done to either mitigate or deal with this, it's not the government that's going to be shoving things down, you know, the farmer's throat. It's going to be, you know, the climate itself when, you know, they're just facing crop disaster after crop disaster. I think that's kind of on, you know, I think that, I mean, reading these reports, you think about the fires in California last year and the hurricanes on the East Coast and how they impacted the livestock industry in North Carolina or farms in California. And, you know, you read these reports and this is kind of the opening moves of what we're going to see down the road. You know, that this is not like the height by any means. You know, it's kind of foreshadowing what could potentially be much bigger impacts in the decades to come.
Well, and there's been the reports just getting worse and worse. I mean, it seemed like over a year ago they were saying, well, we should start seeing something happening, I don't know, like 2050 or so. And now, the most recent reports, they're ratcheting it up. They're not getting more cautious. They're saying it might even be worse than we thought. Even the administration issued a report, and it was a pretty strong one, in spite of the fact that the president has said he doubts that there's anything to it. Still, the administration issued this report and saying that it's coming on like gangbusters. And there have been other reports. United Nations had one, I think, you know, just shortly before that was blaming a lot of agriculture in particular, was focusing on agriculture, you know, where a lot of the problems were taking place and where there had to be radical steps taken to try to get this, you know, taken care of. I wonder, when people are taking shots at agriculture and somehow arguing that we should feel terrible about eating hamburgers when we don't necessarily feel terrible about taking flights, you know, on vacation and so forth. There's other things that contribute to global warming, and food, you could argue, is one of the pretty important things that we'd want to give up. The failure of agriculture, perhaps, to embrace even the terminology, does that make them more likely to be targeted?
Yeah, I don't really think that's the issue. I don't think the fact that these reports are pointing to agriculture reflects the fact that, you know, farmers have, at least in the U.S., have not, you know, persuaded about climate change. I think it really stems from just a recognition of where, you know, global greenhouse gas emissions are coming from. You know, the interesting thing, I think, with global warming is everybody thinks about, we need to switch to renewables, we need to drive, you know, electric cars, you know, all that. That's kind of, I think, a more immediate focus. But I think what's not as well recognized is that agriculture alone creates about a quarter of the emissions of all greenhouse gas emissions. And when you include land that's cleared, say forests, tropical forests, grasslands, that kind of thing, when they're cleared for agriculture, they lose the ability to sequester carbon from the air. In other words, you're not having these perennial trees and other plants that are constantly sucking carbon out of the air and putting it into the ground through photosynthesis. When you expand agriculture, you get this double kind of whammy effect of you sort of lose the carbon sequestration that you had in these lands, and then you're creating more emissions from the agricultural activity itself. So I think that's sort of moving more to, you know, the forefront of discussions. Then once you begin to look at all the various activities in agriculture, from livestock production to fertilizer use to, you know, food waste, which is particularly bad because it creates emissions all, you know, you create emissions in creating the food and then you don't eat the food, it just goes to waste, and so even more emissions are created that way. You know, if you look at all of these things, you know, they add up to a pretty big contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. And thus to climate change. So I think what all these reports are saying is that agriculture has to change if we're going to hope to slow this trend of progressive warming. So So that's kind of the big takeaway.
So if agriculture does represent 25%, you could argue that the product of agriculture is the one thing we can't possibly live without. And I guess the thing I was trying to allude to a little earlier, there are some frivolous things. I mean, there are some people that individuals are making decisions if they're going to want to drive a big suburban V8 and versus a Prius. I mean, there's all kinds of individual decisions that people are making. But if you look at the broad category, and that food, you know, again, is something we can't live without, and that it's 25%, that's kind of understandable that it could be a high percentage. But it's awfully important. At the same time, we're going to need how much more food to feed the population too. So it's
right.
It's not only the current situation, but we got to figure out a way to produce even more food at the same time.
Right. So it's a real conundrum because, you know, with population growth, as you point out, we have to feed many more mouths. And so, you know, we're going close to 10 billion are the estimates by 2050. A really interesting report by the World Resources Institute that came out last week argued that we're going to have to produce 50% more food by 2050. If things went, in other words, if consumption patterns continued the way they are today, with consumption of meat and everything else that we're eating, we need to expand agriculture lands to an area twice the size of India. You know, and at the same time that we're doing that, if we hope to keep warming under 2 degrees Celsius, which is what the aim of the Paris Climate Accord was, to make that goal, emissions from agriculture would have to drop by, you know, 2/3. So how do you get there? You know, how do you increase food production? How can you do it without expanding onto new lands? And how can you do it at the same time that you're cutting emissions? It is a really tall order. You mentioned before, you know, maybe we should all be able to eat hamburgers. But if it actually ruminants, which are animals like, you know, cows and sheep, goats, that kind of thing, I mean, the amount of carbon emissions that come out of livestock are pretty tremendous. There was one figure in this report that beef, for example, accounts for almost half of all emissions in the United States. So beef production, and it only contributes 3% of calories. You know, things like that sort of give you pause and make you wonder, what can we do to kind of change that equation? And the interesting, I mean, the short answer that this report was saying is, like, we don't all have to become vegans. It's just people in the wealthier countries who are eating the bulk of these foods to need to cut back by about 40%. Is that possible by 2050? I think that's what they're, you know, that's what they're aiming at.
But I hear that challenge, though, too, that when you try to put something on the entire world, when you look at around the world, it's actually the people that want to be eating more livestock tend to be as their incomes go up. I mean, you look at the populations that have been living on $2 a day as their incomes go up, and fortunately they are in India and China and other places. Always what they are trying to do is enjoy what we've enjoyed and get more meat in their diet without exception.
Exactly.
Now, there are some that, you know, for religious reasons, there are certain things that they're not eating. But aside from that, every single time that people have a chance to get a little bit more, and they've been on a diet for, you know, 1,000 years,
yeah,
and they're ready to sit at the table and enjoy some meat as part of their meal, it's hard to begrudge that, you know, when you fly across the country and you see most of the country is not arable, but it is grazable. A lot of it is grazable. And the only way we can convert much of that area, isn't it, by having ruminants that can eat product that we are not able to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what this report said was that meat consumption would go up in those poor countries. To sort of temper that expansion, it called for, you know, wealthier countries to cut back. And I guess the goal was something like 1.5 servings of meat, you know, per week. And that's quite a bit difference from when you think about diets where people, you know, could eat meat for lunch and dinner every day. you know, that would be a pretty dramatic change. But even they said even if we cut back that amount, it essentially would prevent the expansion of agriculture, those, you know, into those projected two Indias that I mentioned. So it would halt that expansion. It would also level off emissions. So that one change would be pretty dramatic. But they're not just calling for that. I mean, there's a whole suite of recommendations. But I think, you know, I think it's pretty clear that if this problem is going to be tackled, it's going to some pretty dramatic changes in the diet.
Well, you know, you look around the world, though, too, and this is a global issue. There apparently still are rainforests being cleared and burned. I mean, you're putting the carbon into the atmosphere, you're destroying trees, you know, and perhaps there, I think, see the argument that you're instead, whether clearing the rainforest, they're growing grains for feed, especially soybeans in South America. You know, and that's an issue. It's different than you try to apply agriculture worldwide, and it's complicated. But here in the States, what have you seen as far as the organizations are concerned? Are you seeing any organizations on the food and agriculture side that are saying, we agree this is an issue, and here is what we're going to promote within our industry to move us towards changes, reduction in greenhouse gases and other changes that we're committed to work on as a result of our accepting these findings?
I think, first off, I don't necessarily think these findings are accepted, but I think you do have, you know, large organizations, even, you know, farmer organizations that recognize there has to be some change. So the question is, you know, what are they doing? And so you have instances, for example, you know, have programs where you're using less fertilizer, for example, in your corn crop, because fertilizer, you know, converts into greenhouse gases, pretty powerful ones. And so if you could be more judicious and less wasteful in fertilizer, it could have, you know, it could have a climate impact. And it could also, you know, lead to cleaner waters, because a lot of that fertilizer gets into waterways and, you know, helps contributes to things like the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Things like that have been advocated for a long time, you're starting to see large organizations like the National Corn Growers Association, you know, talk about that. You know, with big dairy operations, you're starting to see some efforts to create methane digesters so that the cow manure, which, you know, the methane from cow manure is a really powerful greenhouse gas. If that can be captured, it can actually be turned into electricity. So you start to see more methane digesters, you know, on dairy, in dairy operations. But again, these are kind of few and far between. But I think there is a recognition that these changes have to be made. I think there's a recognition that even if the current administration is not convinced about climate change, I think these farmer groups recognize that the current administration is not going to be here forever. And I think they're sort of seeing the writing on the wall that changes will be coming, and they're trying to, in some sense, get ahead of the curve. You know, and then you also have researchers who are trying to breed plants that are more adaptable to a hotter climate, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, so these are all measures that are being taken.
So if you look at the effect on the food supply, we need to produce more. That's the big issue we've been talking about in the face of this, which is going to be difficult in and of itself. But when you look at the worst case projections, they're looking at flooding along coastlines. Not too much food's produced in the areas that they're talking about the effect of the high water table, I would guess.
Right.
But, you know, Florida's going to be almost all underwater, according to some reports, at some point in time. But you can go all around the coast, and you can see the coastal areas affected. And that has, obviously, implications on lots of loss and effects on the cities and those areas on the coastal areas and other costs dedicated to that. Doesn't necessarily directly affect food production, probably the radical weather patterns affects the food production pretty much across the board, isn't it? I mean, the places that are hot that didn't used to be so hot.
Yeah, weather.
And the hurricanes and flooding and, you know, and fires like we've talked about before. In general, Sam, have you seen some credible reports that are projecting areas of that are going to be adversely affected and some areas that might even be helped by climate change, that they may find themselves, I've heard people say that some areas of Ontario can look forward to having some commodity grain production competitive with the U.S. Corn Belt, which they were a little on the north side of it before, and things like that.
Yeah, we've definitely been seeing that. And, you know, there's also anecdotal reports about agriculture generally moving northward, you know, in the Great Plains. So potentially that could, you know, the whole grain belt could shift northward. These extreme weather events are really, I mean, the fact that they can, you know, that they're happening pretty much, you know, all over is really worrisome. I mean, I know one farmer in Pennsylvania who does vegetables, and he's been in business since the late 70s, so he's, you know, almost near retirement, but he's had three extreme years of crop losses, which he's never had in the past, and he's also getting new diseases that he hasn't had, soil diseases, and also pest pressures. So pests are moving out of, you know, prior areas and going to new ones. So, you know, these are all things that farmers are going to deal with. And in his case, it's been pretty traumatic in terms of the impact on his business. So I think that's what you're going to see. And I'm sure some will benefit, you know, as it warms, you know, in the north.
So do you envision that from these reports that within a period of time, I don't know, maybe even sooner than 20 years, that people would see much higher prices and less selection at local supermarkets?
That's a good question. In terms of the food supply, and we're talking about a wealthier country, right? So I'm not certain that there is necessarily going to be higher prices, because you're going to have displacement. You're going to have food production moving. So I think given our sort of globalized food production system, I mean, think about all the fruits and vegetables coming from, you know, South America now and Central America to the U.S., Mexico. Tomatoes in greenhouses in Canada and that kind of thing, which are sort of everyday products now in the supermarket, you know, that may increase. And so I'm not certain that there will be. In terms of meat, I mean, what some of these researchers are starting to talk about is a meat tax. So in the same way that you've started to see nascent efforts at a sugar tax to reduce soda consumption, they are sort of openly talking about the possibility of a meat tax as an incentive away from consuming so much meat. I don't see that in the near term in the U.S. I'm not even sure I see it in the long term in the U.S., but potentially, there could be a rise.
But then if people can go to supermarkets and if they can afford it, they'll find pretty much what they've been finding. It might be coming from different regions of the world, like you're saying. Maybe there's some things that have shifted and they're coming down from Canada instead of from North Dakota, or maybe some things are imported. So, but people that can afford to today shop at supermarkets, maybe the cost of food will be higher, but they'll have a selection. Poor people that really hardly can afford food today might be entirely different. But I think it's part of the problem of people to grab a hold of this and hear this abstract idea that this is the end of the world as we know it ahead of us, and try to get it quantified into what it might mean to them and their family personally. It's such an abstract idea, and people have got so many problems to worry about right now, adding global warming to it and what it means to them and their immediate family or their neighborhood. It's really hard to connect the dots.
Yeah, at the same time, though, I think there is a growing recognition of the issue. And I think the fact, just the number of hurricanes, for example, the enormity, the power of them, I think that's opening people's eyes about the potential of what's happening. So I think even for someone who's sort of disconnected from the food system because we just go to a supermarket, I think there's a growing recognition of what's going on. You see, like I'm, for example, in Washington, D.C., and there's a small town up the road in Maryland that has had extreme flooding. People have been killed just from a river that's like overflowed from torrential rains and sort of swamped the town. And this is like an hour outside of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the local news, and it's now happened two out of the past 3 years. That hasn't happened before. And so it's those kind of events, I think, that will kind of wake people up to the fact that things are changing.
Well, let's talk about what happens when they wake up. We have a farm bill, sort of. Was there anything put in this farm bill to address global warming?
I mean, what's happened with the farm bill is essentially they took the last version of the farm bill, wrote it so that it's almost essentially the same as it's been in the past.
So that's a no.
It's sort of status quo.
And then
politically, it's just too difficult. So
the other big thing is to just try to get a consensus of worldwide talking about what they could be doing and what each country could be doing, and that's the Paris Accords, which we are on track to get out of it. The president declared that, he was pulling out, but as I understand it, that can't officially happen until about the time that his term ends. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
So we're in. I mean, even though so people are still going to meetings and still talking, and even though much has been said about us pulling out of the Paris Accords, again, that doesn't happen until the end of the current administration, and if a new administration comes in, they could look at it differently. So that global talk goes on. But the problem with these global conversations, too, is that you still have the places that have to make big changes, like China and India and the United States, are the three biggest contributors to greenhouse gases. You keep hearing stories like China's got like 1,000 coal plants that are still in the process of coming online, which seem like an easy one to make it difficult, if not impossible, for coal energy to keep growing. We can argue about the effect of livestock, but I don't even think there's much argument about the effect of coal.
I think there is a recognition, for example, by younger people about what's going on, or a greater recognition. So that, that could point to political change down the road. But the question is, can these changes happen quickly enough before it's kind of too late? Like, by the time that's the worrisome thing. By 2040, maybe everybody's on board of like, yes, we really need to change now. And by then, it's too late. You're going to get, the warming at a much higher level than had been hoped, and that's going to have all those sorts of impacts. And then the changes you're making won't be able to reverse it, or at least quickly enough.
Yeah, you got to be careful about talking about that, too, because you want people to not just say, well, why even bother trying? It's impossible.
Right. It's pretty sobering reading these reports, I got to say.
You sound like you're convinced.
Of what?
Of how serious it is and that it's not overstated what they're projecting.
Yeah, I mean, I have no reason to... I tend to go with the science. And reading these reports, which are, digestible of the science that's out there, it's pretty it's pretty sobering.
Well, it is sobering, and like I say, it's just hard for the average person, whether you're a farmer or a consumer, to say, what exactly does this mean to me? I mean, possibly, you know, again, there's a young farmer getting started in some area that is growing wheat in Kansas and thinking that maybe I should be looking at my options for Manitoba or something. You know, there's some of those kind of transitions on a broader scale. For a farmer's market, or even greenhouse growing and so forth, it's a little harder. For somebody can raise a couple of acres of greens on the, you know, perimeter of a big city and probably continue to do that. Or they could grow it in greenhouses on rooftops and so forth, as long as they're able to still get potassium and nitrogen and phosphorus and some water and sunlight, that they can probably continue to grow things in unusual places and get much more efficient at it. For a consumer, you know, they probably can still find, they'll find farmers markets, and they'll still be able to go to supermarkets if they can afford it, and there might be some mix of differences and maybe somewhat higher cost. But then come back to this issue, though, and saying more and more people are accepting that this is happening, and that so there will be things to be done with national policy, international policy, trade associations, industries, individual choices, where people can be able to stay informed and you know, again, do what they think is right.
I think what you're pointing out is that change has to come from all these different directions. And I think we tend to think about our own individual choices. And, you know, I got to say, in the past couple of years, I've gotten way more conscious of food waste, for example, just in our own household.
Individuals can make choices. Individuals can reduce their food waste. You can try to understand where your food's coming from and how it's grown. You can decide to put solar panels on your roof. So there's a lot of choices an individual can make. And then an individual, you hope, can communicate to their legislators that there could be policies that are supportive of heading the right direction.
And they could vote for people that they think, you know, support those kind of policies. So,
well, and then I think one other thing that I'm encouraged by too is that consumers are wanting to know how their food is produced, and it's in, and you see more and more companies that are trying to communicate who their farmers are, what their farming practices were, how sustainable they were, packaging changes that they're making in the food products. Counseling how people can keep from, you know, from wasting food, which ends up going sometimes just, it's, you know, it's one thing if it could go always go to a food bank, but oftentimes it's instead just going into waste management, you know, and creating even more greenhouse gases from that, let alone the whole production practices. And what is it that we're wasting, like 40% of the food we produce?
Yeah.
Starting at the field level. This is horrible. So right there, you solve a lot of problems in dealing with those things. So there are steps to keep track and to move ahead. It's going to be interesting. If you look where this argument is right now and you're reporting on all these things, you're seeing the reports, you're seeing the conversations in Washington, D.C. about these issues, what's the most optimistic you can be about it over this next 3 or 4 years?
I think there's going to be some encouraging signs internationally. And at the same time, I think you're going to see, you know, headline news on climate-related disasters that potentially will, you know, propel further changes. So, you know, I think that's kind of, you know, those kind of climate-related disasters, I think that's kind of, those are here to stay for, you know, the foreseeable future, and it's a shame, but it could produce, you know, political action on its own. But you go to these international climate conferences, and I think, I mean, I went to the one in San Francisco, for example, and you come away with a sense that, you know, there really are people all over the world who are working on these issues. And I think that's that's pretty encouraging. And they may not be doing enough. They may not be getting things done fast enough, but at least they're, you know, at least they're trying. And in some cases, they're in pretty powerful positions to be able to, you know, make change. So, so I think all of that is positive.
So you just need to bring some people with you the next time you go to one of these. Bring a,
right.
bring a skeptic or two, whether they're farming or consuming food. Say, come along. Yeah. Sam, thanks for this conversation.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.